I'm here today because Daniel McKay would like to contest the effectiveness of the counsel, of his trial counsel at the remand hearing ordered by the Court of Appeals, and also his appellate counsel's effectiveness during his second direct appeal. Daniel's procedural history is rather torturous. It's summarized on the papers I just gave, Your Honor. Would you care for me to summarize it at this point?
We're familiar with the facts.
I'm sorry?
I said we're familiar with the facts, so yes. Whatever you wish to summarize, you may.
Thank you. After Daniel's first direct appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed in part, reversed in part, and issued the mandate all on the same day, which was September 10th, 2013, which meant Daniel had only until December 9th, 2013, to request post-conviction relief, which he did. He had 90 days after the mandate date to file for post-conviction relief. He filed for post-conviction relief in his first case on February 5th, 2014, I believe. And he had to do that because under Rule 2915, you have 90 days from the issuance of the mandate, which the Court of Appeals issued.
Well, the mandate to do what? The rule says a mandate affirming the judgment or sentence.
It was affirmed in part.
No, there's just affirming and vacating. So they may have said it was affirmed in part.
Well, how was Daniel supposed to know that?
I understand.
I mean, they did rule against him on part of the direct appeal and then remand for hearing, which was not an affirmance and it wasn't a denial. It wasn't an affirmance and it wasn't exactly a reversal. They were remanding for additional information. So
what we could expect him to understand is that affirm means it's over and there's nothing left to do.
Well, that was the mandate, too. Well, I mean, 2915 is very clear. Mandate, you have 90 days. And that's what Daniel was afraid of. That's why he filed for post-conviction relief.
I understand he was protecting himself. But if the court is to hold that the obligation to file, the 90 days doesn't begin to run until the Court of Appeals affirms with nothing left to do.
That's not what the rule says. I wish it did, but that's not what it says.
It says affirm the conviction or sentence.
Boom. And they did. They affirmed. The word affirmed appears in their order. The word mandate appears in their order. That's all that Daniel had to go on.
Okay.
And
indulge me. If we were to say that affirming the conviction or sentence means that all of the arguments rejected and there's nothing left to do, that seems to make his first filing premature. But his second filing, absolutely timely.
That was not a risk that he could take.
He's asking a question going forward. If the court were to hold that, what would that be? He's asking you a hypothetical about this court's judgment.
It would still be a problem for Daniel, because when he filed that first pro se motion, the remand hearing the remand hearing had already occurred, but I don't believe the Court of Appeals had, the second direct appeal was not finished at the time. So when he filed for post-conviction relief the first time, he would have had no idea what would have happened. Am I answering the question?
Well, the question is, if the first one is premature, then the second one is not a successive motion, and it would be a valid motion. Isn't that what you're arguing for?
Isn't that what you want?
yes. But I ordinarily, even with the filing of a premature motion, the case is held open until the conclusion, and then you pick back up on that first pro se. So a second pro se at that point would still be successive. That's how it's usually handled in practice.
And if this court were to try to determine the appropriate meaning of the rule and when a post-conviction motion should be filed, would it make more sense to require a single post-conviction motion? And if you can file only a single one, then don't you have to wait to file it? Not saying there was error or not error in what your client did, until everything's over. So you can file one, because if you file it before it's over, opposing counsel here for the state is saying, therefore, there's no way you can raise any error in the in what happened in the second hearing, because you only get one post-conviction motion and you filed it after the first partial affirmance. Does it make more sense going forward as this court organizes the post-conviction process to have a single filing for post-conviction relief, which would therefore have to be after the whole case is over and ready for post-conviction consideration?
I think certainly this court wanted that when it wrote Rule 2915. Otherwise, it wouldn't have prohibited successive motions. The problem that Daniel was looking at in this case is he couldn't run the risk of not filing for post-conviction relief at that point.
And you're saying it was a risk because prior cases have said if you file prematurely, you're stuck, and the next one is going to be considered successive, even if we recognize the first one was premature?
I think the case law that Daniel was worried about is the case law that says, you know, once you're delivered to DOC, you have to file for post-conviction. Right? Once you're, you know,
but if that's incorrect,
excuse me.
And if that's incorrect, and if it's a premature motion because you have to wait till the full mandate is issued on everything in the case, is he nonetheless in trouble because he filed one early, and that's just too bad in prior cases? Say you can't file another one even if the first one was premature, or has no case addressed this situation?
Well, there is no case that addresses this point because it's a remand hearing under UMDDL, so there is no case that's factually on point. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm understanding the court's question.
Are there cases where two pro se motions have been filed and the second one has been held to be excessive even if the first one was called premature, or successive even when the first one was called premature?
I'm not aware of any.
Okay, I'd misunderstood you earlier.
I would have
you
to
said
research
that.
Premature post-conviction motions usually happen when the person files it after trial and they don't wait for the direct appeal to come around. I am not aware of any cases where a person waited till the direct appeal was over with an affirmance and a mandate, and it was called premature.
And what happens in that situation where they file it before the appeal?
As I explained, it's usually held in abeyance. The motion is we file a motion asking the court to hold the post-conviction case open until after the direct appeal, and then we amend the pro se motion based on what also happened during the direct appeal.
Okay.
But that's not what happened here.
Thank you.
Okay. The problem with what the court did to Daniel is that he did not have a chance to challenge the effectiveness of trial counsel at the remand hearing or of his appellate counsel on the second direct appeal, because the Court of Appeals and this was very unusual, they issued in the first direct appeal, they issued their decision and the mandate on the same day. And that put Daniel in a box. And a box we're still trying to get out of, frankly. And with the way things stand now, Daniel won't have a chance to contest the effectiveness of his counsel at either a remand, from either the remand hearing or the second direct appeal, and that is a problem. That is a huge problem for Daniel, because that was what happened at that hearing was what caused the Court of Appeals to say, no, there wasn't that, although your right to a speedy trial was violated, you didn't suffer any prejudice from it. That was the crux of their not dismissing the indictment against him. And so that's why it's so important that we have a chance to contest the effectiveness of counsel in those two circumstances.
Is there a case law that says if some part of the sentence or conviction is reversed and the case goes down, my recollection would be for resentencing, that there can be a second PCR, but you're limited to what occurred after that remand?
Yes. That's Kniezden,
and that's not
Bain,
what you're wanting.
Like
you're wanting to challenge prior things that occurred prior to the remand, or only after the remand?
Only after what occurred after the second direct appeal decision.
But opposing counsel saying that prior case law does not apply because that was a new sentencing and this is not a new sentencing.
Well, we argued about that in front of the Court of Appeals because there is no, as I explained, there's no case factually on point that tells us. And the Court of Appeals came down saying that they felt that the situation was similar to a resentencing because there was evidence heard, there was a second direct appeal, all the stuff that that ordinarily doesn't happen after a resentencing. Although in Bain, there was a second post-conviction case allowed after a second direct appeal. Because there had been a second direct appeal, Bain allowed a second pro se conviction case. And I think we should get the same chance that the person had in Bain, because although, you know, the state was citing, I believe, Turpin and the other case that just talked about a nunc-pro-tunc order, this was way more involved than a nunc-pro-tunc order. Both counsel and the state presented evidence at this hearing, and there was the second direct appeal. And because there, what happened at the remand hearing was so much more substantive than the nunc-pro-tunc order in the case that the state cites, then I think Daniel should also be able to allege ineffective assistance on that second round. I don't think he should be penalized because he was trying to be careful and following Rule 2915 when he saw the words affirmance and mandate in that first Court of Appeals decision. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issue of, Rule 2915 talks about when the Court of Appeals affirming the judgment begins the clock running on and issues a mandate, begins the clock running. Here we have the Court of Appeals affirming in part, remanding in part was the language that they used in the opinion. Regardless of when the time started running, when Mr. McKay files his first post-conviction relief motion and adjudicates it to completion, whatever the Court of Appeals might have done after the remand, he has already adjudicated a post-conviction relief motion under Rule 2915, and subsection L of that rule explicitly states that the circuit court shall not entertain successive motions.
So did her client have to file something as soon as the mandate issued under our rule?
The state's position is when the Court of Appeals and the first direct appeal affirmed in part, remanded in part, that's when it was affirmed.
So that triggered the duty to file. So you're saying if the Court of Appeals or this court sends a part of a case back down for a hearing, you never get a chance to have that reviewed for ineffective assistance because you have to file immediately on the other part and you don't ever get a then bring up the things you could not bring up in that first part. Is that good policy, and is that required reading of our rules?
All that's required to initiate a post-conviction relief motion is a conviction of a felony after trial. So Mr. McKay could have filed it the minute the circuit court entered its judgment.
If you don't file it timely, you're barred from filing it, right? You waive your right to relief. So
right.
You're saying he had to file it after the mandate issued, even though he could not at that time raise all the issues because his issues he'd raised on appeal were not yet fully resolved.
The first answer to that is the court doesn't have to answer that question because he did adjudicate and litigate.
But you need to answer it now.
I get you, Your Honor, but as far as what this court has to do, that doesn't have to be answered because he did adjudicate it, and anything else that he files is going to be successive. the rule also talks about what happens when there is a remand and when the clock starts running, when a case is remanded and there's a new sentence or judgment issued on remand, then there's an opportunity for the 90 day after that mandate to file another, or to file a 2915 motion. What didn't occur here that would trigger that language is a new sentence or judgment. All the case law deals with when you have a second PCR motion, deals with cases where there was, in fact, a resentencing.
Your argument, to a great extent, opposing counsel's argument, is built on the rock that in the first appeal, the judgment was affirmed and remanded, right?
Right.
And if the trial court had found a UMDDL violation, what would the effect of that have been? What's the remedy there?
Dismissal of the charges.
Right. So he's not convicted. If that had occurred, he would not have stood convicted of the crime, correct?
At that point.
Right. So his judgment isn't affirmed in that case. It's reversed. At least it's vacated, and he's entitled to be dismissed.
Well, the Court of Appeals didn't use those words.
There lies the difficulty. The Court of Appeals may have been less than artful in its terminology. But the effect of what it did was reject some arguments and send some arguments back for further factual development subject to its later review, correct?
And that's where this case is peculiar. And maybe I've not seen this. Normally, in a situation where you have a remand for an evidentiary hearing, and this can occur when there is a confession that was admitted but the trial court did not make a finding on voluntariness, or a motion to suppress issue where the court didn't make findings of fact that it was required to do under the law. Normally, the Court of Appeals will say they will remand it and then direct the trial court to have an evidentiary hearing and then certify the record of the proceedings back up to it, to the Court of Appeals, for a decision. The Court of Appeals didn't do that in this case, and I don't know if it's because in the first direct appeal opinion, it talks about how the prejudice analysis and the decision of whether there was prejudice under speedy trial is the ultimate, I think that's the word, ultimate decision of the circuit court, or it could have just been an oversight
effect, it was just saying there's no error as to all these other points. We don't want to deal with them again. So when it says affirmed on that, but is the judgment actually affirmed if it could be vacated or dismissed? That's the question, really. How is there an affirmed judgment that can go for PCR hearing when whatever happens on remand may mean the judgment is vacated? Understanding the language of the Court of Appeals opinion does say affirmed.
Well, just
and
like...
And so that puts you all in a box, but we're trying to look at it, stepping back from this.
Just like if in a post-conviction proceeding, you could have, if let's say the Court of Appeals doesn't remand this case and they just affirm the judgment, after a post-conviction relief action, the court could vacate the judgment, could set it aside, and either dismiss the charges or hold a new trial. I guess that would be, I think off the top of my head, would be similar to...
Well, but legally, are you affirming a judgment, really, if you're saying we agree with the legal analysis of many of the points, but we don't know yet if the conviction will stand until there's a hearing? How are you actually affirming the judgment?
I'm not going to argue with that that's not a way to look at it. What the rule talks about is a mandate affirming the judgment, yeah, or sentence. If this court holds, there are no cases that talk about this, but if this court holds that is not under the post-conviction rules, affirming the judgment and sentence, then, of course, the state's position on that, that that first result in the first direct appeal, right, that would go against what the state is contesting now. What it appeared to the state is that there might be this loophole about when you have a remand. And in this situation where there was a remand, the hearing was held in January 2014. The court, circuit court, issued its order denying relief. And that brings up another issue, whether the circuit court's order, it denominated order and judgment, but it was basically denying this speedy trial
Why wasn't
claim.
It another judgment in that effect? Because otherwise you're saying there's no mechanism for review of that under the post-conviction rules, aren't you?
Well, what we're first saying is it's not entirely clear whether there was a mechanism of review for direct appeal of an order of the circuit court following a remand. That's why when I mentioned earlier why the Court of Appeals and their mandates and their opinions make sure that the record gets certified back up to it. To appeal a criminal case, you have to have a sentence and judgment. The circuit court's order in this case doesn't qualify, in the state's opinion, as a sentence or judgment.
Normally, the Court of Appeals doesn't issue its mandate until after the hearing. Is that what you're saying?
What they do is, in a situation where they're remanding for a specific evidentiary hearing, is include either in the mandate or the opinion direction for the circuit court to certify the proceedings on remand back to the appellate court for a decision. That's not what was done in this case. So if
it was like there was a second direct appeal, but it didn't include any review of a judgment or sentence.
That would be one way to look at it, and we all know that successive appeals in criminal cases are not permitted. If this wasn't a sentence or judgment under...
You don't get successive appeals on the same judgment, but if, in fact, they it was not a final judgment because there was an issue out, there's no final judgment even if they label it judgment.
If that's the way the court views it, I wouldn't argue against that. All I'm pointing out is that what the Court of Appeals did was merely hold an evidentiary hearing and enter an order, though they called it a judgment, under 30.01 and the statute dealing with appeals in criminal cases. You can only appeal a sentence and a judgment, and Mr. McKay had already appealed a sentence and a judgment.
Well, then the court telling him to send it back here would have been without authority too. So why do you do it when the Court of Appeals says send it certified back up to us? If they've already issued their mandate and that part's final. I mean,
I understand it's all very.
What would be the state's position as to the effect of having had a partial PCR hearing in this particular case if this court were to find that was premature? Would the state then oppose a timely consideration of all the issues in a PCR, that it should have been stayed, or what would the state's position be? If we didn't find it was a successive PCR because the first PCR was premature.
Right. Well, the state's position is it's still successive even if it's the first one was premature.
So what you're really advocating is what Ms. Stroop's saying happens in practice. The first filing should be made, and then the court should hold it in abeyance until everything is concluded.
And then
hold the PCR hearing on all issues.
And that's what is frequently done.
What happens in practice is
right.
Yeah. And what about the, then you'd have to deal with when the amended motion is due, because it can't be due until after additional proceedings in the trial court, or the amended motion can't challenge those.
But and it's yet, also due, you know, on the deadline plus one extension and no authority to further extend it. So I don't know where this abeyance idea comes from, but it's not sanctioned in the rule.
No, and I think it's just by agreement of the parties. They just hold, if there's a premature filing, they just hold it until, well, let's say the defendant files a post-conviction relief action the day after the sentence and judgment comes down from the circuit court. In a routine case, and there's an appeal, in a routine case, that post-conviction relief motion is not going to be due until after the mandate affirming the judgment and sentence.
But your position is, hey, it's filed. He may have filed it earlier than he had to, but it is filed, and that now is the sole only pro se motion.
Right. That is our position. And then there was an amended motion filed, which was filed after the evidentiary hearing on remand was held. That amended motion was filed. There was a hearing. There was an appeal of that first PCR case. It was fully adjudicated. But it
didn't deal with the issues on remand because, of course, there hadn't yet been an appeal of those issues.
Exactly. People
are treating this like they used to treat premature appeals, and now a rule expressly provides if you file it before the 30 days are up, the appellate court holds it until the 30 days are up, and you can formally file an appeal.
Right. Because of the successive language part of the rule, once Mr. McKay adjudicated that first post-conviction relief motion, regardless of whether this first mandate was affirming the judgment or the second one, he already adjudicated. He already had a post-conviction relief motion.
And doesn't that rule contrary to the whole purpose of post-conviction relief?
I understand that, Your Honor, that everything should be unified. The timeliness part of it promotes, maybe not the unified part of it, but what the state is arguing is that he just doesn't have, can seek relief under Rule 2915 for any ineffective assistance that occurred. Though, as I mentioned, he could have included those claims on the evidentiary hearing, since the amended motion in the first case wasn't filed until 4 months after
that
evidentiary hearing.
But he couldn't when he hadn't had an appeal yet.
But he hadn't had the appeal yet, correct.
So would another answer to it be on remand, if you remand part of a case, that you enter a new judgment, you're directed to enter a new judgment on whatever happens, and then you agree in the Bain situation, then you get a new PCR? In that case, a new judgment was entered, a new sentence and judgment. But if we said you shall enter a new judgment.
All I point out to the court is, it would that conflict with Rule 3001 and the statute dealing with appeals in criminal cases, meaning a sentence and judgment adjudication of guilt, that there's consistency there for the court to say, well, whenever a court enters an order on remand, that that's a new judgment, that there needs to be a recognition of, is that consistent with how criminal cases are appealed? Thank you.
Thank you.
This will be on an exam.
I wanted to touch on a few things that came up during Mr. Buchheim's argument. First of all, I think the reason the Court of Appeals remanded is because they wanted the trial court to do the fact-finding. So I think ultimately it was the Court of Appeals that was making the decision on prejudice. But the trial court's order saying there was no prejudice, was that not appealable? Would that have been the sentence and judgment that the state keeps looking for in this case? Could that have been the triggering that allowed Daniel to file again for post-conviction relief, since the order was appealable? Can we not compare the order to the sentence and judgment? And the other thing I was wondering about was, the state's position that, well, Daniel can file his pro se whenever he wants, and then we just hold it around until the second direct appeal is over. That would be lovely, except the rule 2915 that I and every other post-conviction attorney has to live with is that the minute that the pro se is filed, that triggers, in a 2915, that triggers my filing date for the amended motion. So I can't sit around once a pro se motion has been filed. Well, excuse me, it's the appointment day, I'm sorry. But the appointment day usually comes pretty much around the same time as when the pro se is filed. It should. So I can't sit around once a pro se is filed and I'm appointed on a 2915. I can't. I have to file an amended or risk having to file it with a Sanders motion.
So what happens in practice? You're the one who said in practice it's held in abeyance. So what actually do you do?
There is case law out there for when a movement files for post-conviction relief before the direct appeal is concluded. I would not so casually compare those situations to this one, because the Court of Appeals, when they issued an affirmance and a mandate, I would have said that part of the direct appeal was concluded. So I would not want to compare it to the filing the pro se before the direct appeal is concluded, because I wouldn't want to take the risk of advising Daniel when to file a pro se motion and tell him wrong. So that's why I would not wish to compare the two. The difference is, in the first case, you haven't had a direct appeal at all. There's not even been a notice of appeal filed generally. And then to compare it to this case, where there's been a whole direct appeal case, there's been briefing, arguments, and a decision with an affirmance and a mandate. I don't think a post-conviction movement can afford to sit around and hope that some motion court is going to consider that in abeyance. I would not want to take that risk.
What are the cases that say that you hold it in abeyance pending the outcome of the direct appeal if it's filed before that process is completed?
Your Honor, I've done it so often I couldn't even tell you.
Okay. Are they in your brief? Is that an argument that's in your brief, or are we taking you beyond that?
I can provide a list of cases if the court wishes it, where I've filed such motions.
But are there published opinions affirming that that's an okay procedure, or is that just what's done?
It's probably just what's done, and it's not even an issue by the time it gets to the post-conviction case.
Can I ask if either counsel is aware of, or becomes aware of, published opinions addressing this, that they send a copy to the court and to opposing counsel?
I'm also willing to send a list of the cases where I filed motions in abeyance, if you wish.
You can submit what you want.
Oh, okay.
We're not doubting your statement that it happens. We're just trying to figure out.
Well, a lot of these are all Band-Aid solutions that we've had to come up with, right? Because there's nothing in the motion that...
So what you're both saying is our rule works perfectly, right?
Sorry. There's just these goofy situations that come up that we have to deal with. We have to come up with these ad hoc solutions like motions in abeyance, and because the rules, the post-conviction rules, don't really touch on them.
Thank you.
So,
case
thank
will
you.
Be submitted.